And welcome to Access All Areas with Dermot and Felicity. I'm my way access, Dermot Devlin, and with me always is the chronically fabulous Felicity McKee.
This week we're going to be covering a wide range of issues. We are focusing primarily on COVID-related issues, but we have a lot of other interesting things, especially because Dermot has been on television.
Yeah, quite an exciting week, because this has all been part of the Disability Discrimination Act 25th anniversary within the UK.
Yeah, and I have my university celebrating Disability History Month early to correspond with that. So there's lots of different events happening on both sides of the channel. Well, the sea.
So now we're just going to have a little discussion on some of the things that have been happening in the news this week. So Felicity, has anything caught your eye this week that you feel would be worthy of our listeners here at Access All Areas?
So one of the main stories that caught my eye this week was the fact that every 15 minutes on average, a patient with learning disabilities is being restrained in a hospital last year. Now, these statistics are for England, but it did find that in 2019, restraint was used just over 38,000 times in England. And in 2017, there were 22,000 reports of restraint. So Harriet Harman, who is chairwoman of the House of Commons Joint Select Committee on Human Rights, said that this suggested inhuman and degrading treatment. And I would say that there's no suggesting about it. The Department of Health has said that restraint should only be used as a last resort. However, it does appear that it is on the rise. Now, there could be arguments that this is down to short staffing and other issues, but I, as a person who has a learning disability and as a person who has friends who are autistic, who are currently inpatient in mental health wards, which do not have staff who are autism aware, I'm aware that restraint isn't always being used as a last resort, unfortunately. And there are a wide range of reasons why this could be happening, but at its core, the problem is that disabled people are once again bearing the brunt. And so there's not enough staff, so staff are then stressed. There's not enough training, so staff aren't autism aware. And people who do need more specialist treatment aren't able to access that because those hospitals are really far away. So lots of different reasons behind it, none of it good. And I think the sharp rise in it is definitely worth note and something that we should be keeping an eye on and possibly linking in with politicians to try and change it, because there are people who have died while being restrained. And so when it is meant to, like when they say it should be a last resort, it really should be the last resort. And, you know, the BBC found that using the prone restraint or holding people face down remains high, despite the fact that it's actually against government guidelines. So it's illegal. It shouldn't be happening, and it is happening. So that's definitely an issue.
But it's something that is very alarming, because it kind of reflects as well what's happened to school with autistic children, where they've been restrained and excluded. So it is like it's a major problem issue in hospitals and wards, but it is something that has to be sort of overlooked and overseen across the board as well. Like, for example, like I know that some of the parents with autistic children in primary school, they've been concerned about information surrounding mandatory ASD training, which was agreed by the Northern Ireland Executive in February this year. But they're still wondering, like, what has been agreed. You know, what does the agreement consist of? Who's been involved in planning this? And crucially, like, has there been any involvement from input was from autistic people themselves or their parents? Or is it crucially just been led by charity? So, I mean, it is transparency needed within the school, but it also, as you say, it kind of reflects back and as well as the wards. So, you know, it is a problem overall when it comes to people with learning disability or who are autistic, that more needs to be done. They seem to be sort of, for want of a better word, cast aside and treated differently from as it would be from maybe non-disabled people. And this is a much greater issue that needs to be dealt with, like, across the board.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to see and hear these stories, because sometimes when we see these numbers, we don't see the faces behind them. And one of the things that I did when I was doing my master's is I looked at health passports, and the idea being specifically I was looking at mental health passports because there had been an increase in adverse incidents in some of the local hospitals, and it works out about 3p a patient. And the idea being, depending on what you put into the passport, it can include medications that work, medications that haven't worked, a guide on like if this person is having a meltdown, these are the steps to do, what not to do, who to phone, basically like a how-to manual for the person. Because a lot of staff, if someone ends up in a general ward, they maybe aren't, they haven't had training in a disability, specifically like a learning disability, or they haven't had training in mental health awareness or what to do if they have a mental health patient on a general ward. And one of the things that I was aware of when I was working in healthcare was that sometimes what gets called or classed as challenging behavior is down to a miscommunication. So me and the patient, we're maybe not on the same page. They get frustrated because they're not conveying what they think they're conveying to me, and like we're missing the mark with each other. And so sometimes people, when they get frustrated, they can appear to get a bit aggressive. And it's not necessarily that they are being aggressive at me. They're probably just frustrated, and you never know. Maybe they've had like five people so far that haven't understood them, and it's kind of like a slow build up. And for me, I felt that the health passports were a way of maybe removing a communication issue and allowing patients to feel like they had more input in their healthcare, because there was a section for them to write notes. So like, I didn't get this, or could you explain that next time they meet the patient? And then also a healthcare professional could see which previous appointments they had, what had been said. Because while we do have an online system of healthcare notes, sometimes, you know, it takes a wee while for things to catch up, and sometimes stuff gets hidden underneath everything else. I know when I'm trying to find documents about myself, I sometimes have to provide the very date that it was sent on and by who for a physician to find it. And there is actually a health passport of sorts, which was designed by Public Health in Northern Ireland. It has like a traffic light system, but I do find it very, very simplistic, very basic. So it is kind of user-friendly, but I don't think it necessarily provides the full amount of information that you might require. It is kind of just a very basic introduction to that person and maybe what medication they're taking. So health passports, definitely something I think, which they're not going to solve this issue, but I think they're a really interesting area to explore. And I know that my research definitely showed that. And I would love to see more use of it. I know that Queen's University was looking at health passports for young adults, and I believe a friend of the show, Michaela Hollywood, was involved in that.
I'd love to learn more about that. You know, but as I say, like Michaela has been involved in quite a lot of things now over the last few days. In fact, what I think you discovered yourself during the week with Michaela was regarding the Northern Ireland Independent Living Fund. So Michaela seemed to be the face of it, and possibly one of the driving forces here in the north to ensure that this comes back after it was stopped quite a few years ago, which impedes on the disabled people living a fully independent life. So that, I mean, that's great. Like I know there's been an article recently in the a website, the Disability News Service, where they had interviewed her. So it's just basically covering that there that disabled people in Northern Ireland are hoping to pursue that the devolved government, Dáirmin, will reopen the Independent Living Fund for new claimants for the first time in 10 years. So, to see, like, with all these cutbacks and benefits, you know, with PEPs coming in and universal credit, like, all sort of different things, you know, under the Conservative government, people with disabilities, disabled people, so they're being pushed more and more into the poverty line. So something that bringing in the ALF again will be a massive contribution for disabled people. And I know this is something that the Scottish Independent Living Fund have been promoting. In fact, they had put out a survey just before the summer trying to engage the views and opinions of people here in the north just to find out what exactly it is they need and want from the Independent Living Fund, something which I promoted on My Way Access, filled out myself. So I'm looking forward to see what the fruition of this is. And, you know, and I'm glad to see there's somebody that, you know, like a strong character like Michaela, who we both know is one of the main driving forces behind this. And, you know, when we both know that when Michaela gets behind something, things get done.
Yeah, like especially the new toilets that Michaela helped spearhead in Castle Court in Belfast. So if you see any of the Changing Places toilets, that was Michaela. So that's the face behind why there's those fabulous toilets available. But you know, that's not the only news to do with government issues and disabilities. So it was recently found that Department of Work and Pensions had unlawfully blocked support for disabled students for 7 years, and that many disabled students were blocked from trying to claim the benefits they needed to pay for essential living costs. And this was found in a court document that the DWP had misunderstood the relevant law, and it had rejected disabled students' claims for universal credit without allowing them to undertake a work capability assessment. Disability Rights UK, which has been campaigning against DWP's unlawful policy since 2017, has stated that 30,000 students could have been affected. And this is definitely something that I know that I experienced when I went on medical leave. I was told that as a student, I wasn't entitled to apply for employment support allowance, even though I was on medical leave. They said I had to give up my degree if I wanted any support, but I couldn't qualify for job seekers because I was too sick. But then I was told by an OT that I was too sick for employment support allowance, but they wouldn't let me do the back to work scheme to even try and support me in finding a job. So you can only get it, or at least you could only get it at that point if you got the higher rate of disability, which I did, but the government decided to not mention that to me. So I happened to find out by going to Turn to Us and just seeing it mentioned somewhere where I had to print out the document and bring it in with me to say, actually, I qualify, and you've been telling me I haven't, which is illegal for like 2 years. But it's the fact that it is constantly a fight to access benefits that people are entitled to. And a lot of the time, there is a lot of sort of shaming around accessing benefits. And this idea that disabled people are benefit scroungers, and it's really harmful because like the actual rates of people who are falsely, and I use that with air quotes, claiming benefits is really, really minor. And even then we see news stories about people, especially if they have a fluctuating condition. So there'll be like a photograph and it's all like they were in a wheelchair this day and today they're not. They must be faking. And like I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user. I'm not always using my wheelchair. That doesn't mean that I'm faking it when I'm using my wheelchair. I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of scaremongering around this issue. And it's really sad. Stories like this just make me really sad.
That does seem really like it is a problem, like in, not just with disabled people, but if you belong to a minority somewhere in society, you will be scapegoated. But again, not to say that disabled people don't do it, have it too, because it is. I mean, I have been there myself where people have been sort of whispering and pointing, and I've heard them talk about, I've actually been reported a couple of times for because my access doesn't make any money. In fact, anything it does be pumped into that. But I've been reported on a couple of times of making money not declaring it. So the HMRC invested me twice over the last 7 to 8 years. So both times come back proved that I was right in what I was saying, that I don't make any money, and any money that was under my way access is my own money, which unfortunately I don't have a lot, which is why it mightn't be as fancy and as shiny as a lot of different types of websites, but it's pretty basic, but it gets the information across that I want to do, so I'm happy enough with that. But it brings back to what you were saying, Felicity, it's because people are seeing me and they think, well, yeah, he uses a wheelchair, but he's out all the time and he goes to the bar and all the time, and so he goes to Comic Con. He's not that bad, really. So he's making all this money out of the website. So they'll report me, not even ask me about it, but they'll do it on the sly. And unfortunately, I'll never find out who they are. It might have my suspicions, but they can never prove it. So it just proves that, disabled people are an easy target to be scapegoated in
Yeah.
society for this, that, and the other.
And I think, like I have the same issue because I'm in the hospital all the time. And I'm kind of in this catch 22, whereas when I go into hospital, if I was to take a break and allow myself the break because I'm in hospital, work will pile up. I will get anxious. I will then have to do the work. And because I'm trying to catch up with work, I'll probably land in the hospital again. But there's also the issue of that when I'm in the hospital, because I've been in so often, people no longer sort of treat it with the gravity that it deserves. So I'm in because I'm having an electrolyte imbalance, which is caused by like multiple different health conditions that I have that kind of all link in and just cause an electrolyte imbalance. That can kill you. I'm usually in because my heart is at risk. And like, I usually have like cardiac monitors and things attached to me, but people seem to sort of think I'm just like in having spa treatment. I literally had someone tell me that, you know, I'm so lucky that I get to have this time to relax.
Really?
And I was like, yeah, hospital's relaxing.
I haven't been in hospital maybe quite as regularly as you have been, but there have been quite a few times over here where it'd been maybe slightly more regular. But I can tell you, anybody that's it's not relaxing.
Oh, no, it's definitely not.
But I think that really covered just what our local news is this week, you know, regarding the disability news. So we'll just take a little break now. So if you want to put the kettle on and maybe get the Mark Miles out, we will see you on the other side. Hello and welcome back to Access All Areas. I hope you got the marshmallows ready. Now we're going to have a little discussion about COVID and just some of the stuff surrounding it this week that we feel is important to raise that might have been forgotten about or ignored in the wider media. So Felicity, if you maybe want to start off on the point that you would maybe like to cover around the virus this week.
Yeah, so I have a lot of direct experience of COVID during lockdown, one, because I was shielding, but two, because this week I got to have multiple COVID tests. I went inpatient, and so I got tested on arrival, but I also got tested again while inpatient because they found that a patient in the side ward with me had what was termed low-level COVID, which I'm not really, like, it wasn't really explained to me, but apparently some of the tests, it's something to do with the DNR and it can show what appears to be a positive type test and it gets retested. So I had a bit of a COVID scare, but going into hospital during the COVID pandemic is interesting. It's very different from my previous day. So the previous time I went in, there was a lot more social distancing. And I also had a COVID scare because they moved a patient into the side ward during the night. And when the day staff came on, they panicked because apparently this patient had shared a room with someone who had suspected COVID and our side ward went into lockdown. And at that point, we were all wearing masks for the entire stay in the hospital. So it only came off for medication and for food. Although when we did go into lockdown, a lot of the patients didn't want to use the commode and kept sneaking out, which isn't really a full lockdown. But I get it because like the commode is not the most pleasant of things. But at the same time, really bad on them. But this time when I was in, though, once I'd got past the waiting room, which was packed, and I had gone on my own because I didn't want to bring my partner, who's also my carer, because I was like, there's more chance of exposure. Say if we get separated, they could get exposed somewhere else, bring it back to me. We increase our chances of exposure that way. But there were large groups. So people with plus threes, plus fours, it was very hard to social distance. And when I did get into the side ward, a staff member told me that I could take my mask off, which really surprised me because I had worn it the entire time when I was in overnight the previous time. And I've worn it the entire time when I'm inpatient upstairs for like day treatment. So that was a change in routine. But I think what really struck me was how difficult it is to see the staff members under all that PPE. So some people had put their names onto the visors, which is great because, you know, you can't see who that person is. But it's very difficult to hear people. It's very difficult to recognize people. And like I had one staff member who was like taking my blood to go, "You don't recognize me, do you?" And I could recognize the voice, but because I couldn't see them, it was very difficult. And I think maybe if they'd had like a little, I've seen it somewhere online where people do like laminated photos of themselves and have it on the PPE, that could have been really helpful for like recognizing the staff member. Cause like I do know most of them. And usually when I go in, it's all like, "How's the kids? How's this? How was that Welsh lesson? You were learning Welsh last time I was in," things like that. And it was very different this time. So I've seen it at two different ends of the pandemic and there's similarities and there's huge differences. And I don't know, it was definitely a different experience. And this time, when I was doing the patient admission, and I've done these forms a lot, and like God bless the staff, those are massive documents. There was two big booklets to fill in. For some reason, and it's never been asked before, and I don't know if it's down to the fact that people have made assumptions and just not asked. And like, I've been in resus, so I would have thought this question would have been asked before. I was asked whether or not I wanted to be resuscitated, and I had to sign, which is different. And I'm wondering if it's part of the pandemic, or if it's always been there and people just didn't assume because of my age and therefore didn't ask. So it's one of those ones that I don't know, but I did feel that the question wasn't provided with suitable information to know about the risks or anything about resuscitation. It was kind of thrown in there, like almost sort of like, what do you want for dinner in the form?
Yeah.
And it is one of the things that I have noticed that sometimes in the hospital forms, people do make assumptions. So like I've had the entire mobility section, someone's just like put a big line through it and they never ask the questions. And then they've gone on and then they notice that I have a walking stick and they have to go, oops, and go back. So like there are some assumptions based off age and based off other factors. And so I don't know why this has never been asked before, like with the patient admission forms. I don't know if it's always been there, if it's new. There was no explanation, but I did find it quite jarring just how it was presented. I think especially because with COVID and because we've heard of the death rates of disabled people in hospital, and then to find out that potentially I had been exposed when inpatient was quite scary as well, because there's that limbo when they're doing the rapid test to retest the other patient and you don't know. And the issue was each time I've been told that even though I'm high risk, even though they potentially expose me, I will be going back to halls where I'm surrounded by other students and potentially spreading there. But also my problem is I have ongoing treatment in the community that even when I was shielding, I had to access. So if I had to self-isolate for 2 weeks, how do I access the treatment that keeps me alive? Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. And you know, I did feel for the staff because they are very understaffed and there does seem to be a little bit of confusion about some of the information on the ground. But it was a very stressful experience because you can't see the people. You have difficulty hearing what the people are saying. And also then you're sort of hoping that other people are going to adhere to the guidelines. And like you and I have experienced it where someone's been quite rude about disabled people, or, you know, they've said that, I mean, you can say what that person said to you online, but like I had similar where he was sort of like, well, if you're going to die, you're going to die. I shouldn't have to adhere to guidelines. And so when you're in a space where you need people to be social distancing and people are there in large groups, which I thought was against the rules at the minute, you know, I'm constantly thinking about the fact that hospital is one of the only other locations that I go to. I go there because I have to. And like, I remember saying to the doctor, like, I really didn't want to go inpatient that night. I was worried about exposure. And I agreed because I had to. But when you're in, there's, you know, the worry about hospital and the general anxiety because you're in a hospital, but the additional anxiety of hoping that other people are going to adhere to guidelines. And when they don't, it's difficult. Although my pet peeve in a hospital waiting room is, you know, when people wear the masks, but they don't cover their nose. I feel like there needs to be a large sign which has like a photograph of that with a big X through it on the wall, just massive, blow it up, like A3, bigger than that, just huge sign. But it's a very anxious time. And, you know, when you don't know who staff are and you can't recognize people and there's all these other people, that's stressful. But then the potential exposure to COVID as well. Plus, they never explained that the COVID test was a COVID test. They're just like, we just need to swab you. Next thing I know, I have a swab going into quite deep down. But nobody explained. It was only sort of like when they had the COVID scare that they're like, oh, don't worry, we've already tested you. Because I'm used to swabs all the time because I've been in different hospitals. So for infection control, I get all the swabs. So it didn't occur to me that this was a COVID test. But I have tested negative more than once, so that's the good news.
I'm delighted to hear that. But no, I cannot have been a very worrying experience, Nick, because like, I'm lucky enough that my health was maintained quite well over the period. So I've only really been in the hospital maybe two or three times as an outpatient just for tests, you know, but I didn't have much contact with many people, only those that I was necessary to be near. And even within the hospital itself in the waiting room, you know, everybody was well spaced out. So my experience has been quite good. But then again, I've just been lucky that way because I've heard all the horror stories from a lot of people, including yourself, which you've just mentioned, which can be, I'm sure, quite traumatic when you go through it. Even as you were telling me the story last week, which you sort of alluded to now regarding some of the treatment you've got in the shop from an elderly gentleman who basically didn't value your life whatsoever. You know, something similar happened to me since the last podcast too. Only my experience was online. So while it was quite harsh and upsetting for me, and it did upset me quite a lot, you know, to actually get it in person like you did would have been a whole lot worse. You know, like the person that said to me in a public forum, it wasn't like in a private Facebook group or private message, it was on a newspaper website or newspaper Facebook group, who basically told me that my life wasn't, I'm just someone up here paraphrasing, but the summary was that my life didn't have the same value as the economy and his life, and he deserved to get out there and live his life as it should be, and people like me were just holding them back, so my death would be worse than getting back out there again.
Yeah, that's...
But I did talk more detail about it in another podcast that I guest on last week was Stephen Doran. So you can probably find that podcast, you know, in the usual places. It is I can send the link below just for you to click on it. So it was great to join them on the podcast last week. So there's no point really repeating the story what happened to you because, you know, I can send you a link and you can share it out because it's not something really like to relive over and over again. But
yeah.
I still think it's important to get that message out. Well, I'll share it below, okay?
And I think, you know, it's difficult, especially now, because we're seeing a lot of issues that people are facing with invisible disabilities because of mask exemptions and things like that. And it's just, hate crime against disabled people is on the rise, unfortunately. And I do think COVID is playing a small part in that, but like it has been on the rise prior to COVID.
It has been on the rise, but, and you may say it's partly to do with COVID, and obviously it's been slowly rising for that. But I do think it's, and I don't know the exact figure, but I'm talking anecdotally here from my own experience and what I've witnessed happening to other people. It has sort of shot up a lot more than what it would have been. Like the rate of what it's grown now feels to me in a way that it's increased a lot more than it has before that. But I think I don't know about what it is across the rest of the North Sea and the UK, but I believe in the man I know, I was chatting to a PSNA officer last year before everything sort of went sort of chaotic in 2020. I think we were one of the lowest rates in the UK regarding the rate that was increasing, which is roughly around 1.2%, which is not great, but compared to what other regions have been experiencing, it's not too bad. But as I say, I've seen a lot more evidence over the last 8 or 9 months of it happening, so I say it's beyond that now.
Yeah, and so Inclusion London, so obviously this isn't Northern Ireland based or Welsh based, but they were doing a sort of weekly survey, and it was in regards to sort of like disability hate crime and following rates during lockdown. And they found that there was a rise in hate crime committed by neighbours of disabled people. So this was a rise in hate crime against disabled children whilst they were at home by neighbours. Disabled people were experiencing being spat at whilst out of the house due to inaccurate perception that disabled people were virus spreaders. There was an increase in online hate crime. Many were saying that they had been targeted whilst out shopping if they have carers or assistants, or if they were getting prioritisation in queues. There was lots of different things. People with learning disabilities and neurodiverse conditions may not be fully aware of restrictions put in place under lockdown due to a lack of accessible information. And they said that often they will not immediately appear disabled. So again, air quotes around this, so their behaviour may not be understood by the police or the general public. Disabled people have felt that they're not being treated fairly when reporting incidents of disability hate crime. They feel that they're not being believed due to previous negative experiences. I mean, it keeps going on. But basically, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand that, you know, a lot of disabled people, our lives have been put entirely on hold. And then when it comes to government policy and updates, we're not really being factored in at all. And, you know, there is the Disability Service News was reporting on the vaccine priority list. And some disabled activists have said that it's sickening or utterly bizarre to put disabled people who are seen as extremely vulnerable to coronavirus really far down the queue for the vaccine when it eventually becomes available. And this is the Pfizer vaccine, the one that's been 90% effective in preventing COVID. And although it's not approved yet, the government has said that if and when it was, the NHS stands ready to begin a vaccination program for those most at risk, as currently recommended by the Independent Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, before rolled out more widely. But the current advice by that committee shows that disabled people at serious risk of COVID-19 are well down the list of priorities for vaccine, even though 3/5 of COVID-related deaths have been disabled people. So the provisional ranking for priority means that older people in care homes and care home workers would be the first vaccinated. And like, I do understand that. That's then followed by over 80s and other health and social care workers. And yes, obviously health and social care workers deserve vaccinated. But next comes those over 75, then those over 70, and then those over 65. So adults under 65 who are at high risk from the virus are 6th on the list of priority. And I'm not really sure why, like, I do understand that obviously we have to do it in batches because, you know, there's limited resources, but we do make up like 3/5 of deaths. You would think we'd be slightly further up the list. Just slightly.
It is, like, it's a very worrying development because I was quite excited when I heard that the vaccine was going possible. Like, I know there was some story that was going to be out by the end of December and January, but I wouldn't feed into that because, you know, to me, that's far too soon because, you know, yeah, fair enough, it's 90%, but then, you know, there's a lot of work that'll have to be done to get it approved. And
there will be booster shots. It's, you know, people will probably need boosters. There was, I was reading a press release from a company that a family member happens to work for. So no bias here, but I was reading a press release and it was suggesting that there may need to be booster shots, that there was some research that, you know, like top ups that people would get for COVID. But again, you know, research is constantly changing and updating. So I think my main worry about the vaccine is, like, I was told I could get the flu jab, but I wasn't allowed to get the pneumonia jab. So I don't know how they're going to make the decisions about who definitely does qualify, because I was told a shield, but I didn't get a shielding letter. So do you know what I mean? Like, there's going to be people who fall through the cracks. And it is a concern, because if we have to pay for it in boots, because there will probably come a point where it's accessible for people to buy in boots, there will be disabled people who maybe do not have the money, who are being told that they cannot get the flu jab, or not the flu jab, the COVID jab, for whatever reason, and they're having to pay for it with money that they maybe do not have. I don't know, because, like, I know if it was available on boots and I couldn't get it on the NHS, I'd probably pay for it because I am worried, and this could kill me.
Again, it just brings back that it's something that disabled people have to do over and over again, which is kind of ironic because it falls in the week of the 21st anniversary of the Disability Discrimination Act, which just shows, again, it kind of highlights the fact that when we want equal service, that we want equal rights, that we continually have to fight for it. And it just looks like this could be another fight that we have to get. Now, I'm not saying that we prioritize over people in nursing homes or over 80s, but we should be a lot higher up that list than currently that we are. And it's just going to be another fight that we're going to have to take. You know, I'm getting tired now of fighting all the time, but, you know, I'm still ready to take this fight because, you know, if I don't, and if you don't, and if everybody else doesn't, then, you know, we're just gonna be forgotten about yet again. So, ironically, it will be the big public people out there now who will say, maybe on social media, the last 9 months that they're not going to get vaccinated, they're anti-vaccine. It's all Bill Gates. But once this vaccine comes out, they'll probably be higher up the queue than us, and they'll probably take it.
Well, some of them will. My worry is those who won't take it, because like you do need to have a certain amount of the population that has agreed to be vaccinated and has taken the vaccine, really to help create the idea of herd immunity. So like there will be people who maybe can't take the vaccine for medical reasons. There are some people who can't take vaccines or who are more at risk of catching certain illnesses, and they need other people to be vaccinated. And so I am quite concerned about the amount of people who potentially will refuse to be vaccinated. And I think I was quite concerned about what would happen in America, especially when it came to vaccines and COVID. So I'm quite hopeful with Biden having been elected that maybe that could change. Because like in the back of my head, when I thought about like the pandemic, America kind of was the place where I felt like even if we resolved it everywhere else, America would probably still be one of the areas where like spread would happen from. So we would maybe fix the UK and Ireland, and then suddenly it would be back again because someone from America who had it had flown in or something like this. And just because of how like the rates in America are absolutely shocking. I think someone's dying like every 15 minutes.
The thing is, I know you're saying you might be a bit more confident now that Biden is the president-elect. But I do think that American power is now. So while he is president-elect, he will become president in January, despite what some politicians in America might believe. But unfortunately, the damage is there, the polarization, and Trump still has too many influence on too many Americans, and they still will refuse. Because don't forget that Donald Trump has got over 70 million, probably more than that. How many votes did he get? Over 70 million now.
I don't know if it was over 70 million. I think that was Biden. He did get, like, it was something like 49-51%. It was, I mean, it's close, but there's about 5 million votes, I think, between the two of them. So let's say 65-70. I'm not exact on the numbers, but there's...
Well, if it is 65-67 million, that's a lot of people that will still listen to Trump and still follow his tweet who will not take the vaccine. You seen them there yesterday, at the weekend, and they're protesting. Now, Trump said it was over 1 million of them protesting, but I might just be 10 numbers because Trump said that, but it's still a sizable number of people. But that's not to take away, like, I mean, you know, if you're going to be covered by that, you have to be covered by about everything. Like, I was delighted to see that Biden won the American election, but I was still very upset to see the celebrations and people celebrating and personally to each other. There's still quite a number of them didn't wear masks. So, you know, I can't criticize Trump and his supporters and not say the same about Biden and his supporters too, because they equally were socially mixing with each other, which they shouldn't have been done without the mask and stuff like that. So even though still quite a lot of Trump supporters who were caught up in the euphoria, got caught up in the excitement. And this will happen over the next 2 or 3 months, especially on the inauguration, they're still going to mix. So, unfortunately, I don't have the confidence in America just yet. Maybe in 6 months' time, but just not yet, unfortunately, Felicity. So, maybe close the borders in America. I know Trump wanted to put the wall up. They keep putting people out. Maybe we should put the border up in America and put the wall up in America. Keep them on fair way.
Yeah, it is very sad when you look over to America and see how polarized it's become. But then I think we have a lot of polarization in politics over here anyway. But it has been quite stark to see it happening in America, and especially during a pandemic, because, you know, we do need to be kind of unified in this fight internationally and globally for this. And it's sad when you look at sort of the funding that has been cut by America to certain health organizations and things like that. So it's just, it's difficult, I think. I think COVID's difficult for everyone. I think as a disabled person, it's especially difficult. And it's just, it's sad to see kind of where it's going. But there is hope with the vaccine. I am very conscious that, like, I do have to chase things and generally have to fight for healthcare. Although I did get good news about healthcare recently. I have finally got the pain management team. to like on the phone, and I have an appointment next week. And it's only taken like 5 years in Northern Ireland and like 2 years in Wales, but I have made it and I am very excited. But it took a lot of chasing.
It's up my house, by the way. I'm absolutely delighted. People have been there 7 years, but in disability terms is not that long.
Oh, it feels like a lifetime.
In normal terms and non-disabled terms, that's a lifetime. But you know what? Fantastic news. I mean, it's just really 7 years fighting. That shouldn't happen.
Yeah, it's
should not happen, like.
It's, you know, it's just, it's more the fact that, like, I think a lot of disabled people will tell you that there's a lot of emotional labor and like actual time put into chasing healthcare. So, you know, referrals get lost, people lose paperwork. And so that's why I keep a copy of absolutely everything that I can, so that when I phone up places, I can be like, well, actually, on this date, I spoke to this person, and this is the letter that was sent, and it's dated this, and this is the reference. And it's so much work, because it shouldn't be my job when I'm not well to have to chase things. And I think when it comes to things like the COVID vaccine, that's one of my worries, because I do know that, like, I've got the flu, but then I was told I just couldn't get the pneumonia jab. And I was pretty sure the list for the things were quite similar. So I'm not sure how that's happening. And it's that kind of a shield, but you're not getting a shielding letter, that has me worried about accessing this vaccination, because, you know, if they offered it to me tomorrow, I would be first in the queue.
Definitely. I mean, somebody had said to me recently, like, would I be part of the trial? Now, I was Lyme and Bumison, so that would rule me out. But I said that if I wasn't on Bumison, I'd be rolling my arms up as we speak and putting my arm out and just saying, put it on me, because, you know, disabled people, they just, you want it now.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be 6, 7 kids on the list, which could potentially add another year, 18 months of us in isolation and being secluded from life. So it's not good enough. But it is something that we do face, because even to get them in the cell, plus, as you're aware, and some of our listeners are aware too, like, there was a hard fought fight by us people more healed in the UK, and myself have fought for it. Like, this was a fight for many years to get it approved. Thankfully it did, and it made a remarkable difference to my life and many, many others. As you know, like, I've been off it for a while, so I've been back on it now 5 weeks now, and I'm not back up to pre-lockdown levels yet, I'm definitely a lot better than what I would have been 3, 4 months ago, where my energy levels have just stopped. Admittedly, the energy levels were all over the place this week, because I had no energy, but mainly today, because I was running like a head of chicken all week with the BBC and whatnot. But on Friday I got to Mummerson, and yesterday when I got out of bed, I was just bursting with energy again. And it just, you know, it just shows you that treatment needs to be there, the drug needs to be there, not just Mummerson, but, you know, whatever disabled people need. Of course, this COVID vaccine, when it comes, we have to be, now I don't say we have to be number one on the list, because obviously you've got, you've really needed health home like up there, but we have to be right up there in the mix of it, not just down there at the very bottom of the list, or down, not even down in the middle of the list, but we have to be one of the priorities. But that's something we can fight, and we'll take it to the government again, like everything else we do.
Yeah, I think it's mostly more, because I do understand that obviously staff need to be vaccinated and things like that, but I think it's more the fact that as a group, disabled people and people who are shielding, who are basically disabled people, we have kind of been bottom of the list when it comes to a lot of public announcements, policy things. And so it's just kind of an ongoing issue that generally we are feeling ignored, forgotten, and kind of disposable. So the idea that, you know, like when that person said to you, oh, you know, was it, I want to get my life back and things like that. It is an attitude that I've seen of, is all like, oh, well, you can just stay inside. And I'm like, well, there's disabled people who have jobs to do and who have to work. And there are disabled people who, you know, are back out there because there is no shielding list now and are having to work in retail and other places, and they deserve protection too. And it's just, it is the lack of thought, I think, and I think it's the callousness in which some people have suggested that our lives are disposable, which maybe has made some of us have quite this knee-jerk reaction when we see that we're continuously at the bottom of the list. Because it's just like it's like an overall attitude or a vibe within society, and it's upsetting, it's frustrating, and it's really obvious. So like before, I think lockdown, you know, for us it was really obvious because we're disabled, and it maybe wasn't obvious to other people, but now there's big flags that non-disabled people can see, and they can't say that they haven't noticed them, because you know, they're everywhere, they're huge flags. Was it if you're not noticing them, was it you're at least like catching them out of the corner of your eye, or hearing, you know, big gusts of wind as they wave? It's not even like, it's definitely not subtle, and it's everywhere, and you see it sometimes in headlines as well, and it's just, it's sad and it's difficult, and I think people don't realize just how difficult it is.
Well, this is something that I'd love to hear more about from some of the listeners, so maybe if you wanted to drop us a little tweet at, you can tweet me at My Way Access, and Felicity, do you want to give out your tweet handle?
Yeah, so it's McKee_Felicity, so that's FelicityY.
So if you'd want to drop us a little tweet, or maybe drop us a little email between now and the weekend, just to maybe give us a quick sentence or a quick line just about how you feel about COVID as a disabled person, and what your hopes are with the vaccine, because we'd love to hear your views. And not only that, if we get any feedback, we will read them out next week's podcast, because we want to share your views as well. It, you know, this podcast isn't just Felicity and me talking. We want to share your views as well. So please do get in contact, because my way, all access all areas is for everybody. It's just not just for Felicity and I. So please do get in contact, and we will share your views with everybody. So we're just going to take a little break now, and we're going to get back after the break. We're just going to chat about what's been happening in each other's lives this week. And that'll see us right through to the end. So put the kettle on, and we will see you after this short little break. Hello, welcome back to Access All Areas. Now we're just going to be chatting a little bit about what's been going on in our lives this week. So Felicity, what would you like to chat about today?
Well, I think your recent work with the BBC is very interesting. Like, we've already covered my experience in hospital a little bit. So I went in on Tuesday for an overnight stay. But I think your BBC work is a lot more exciting than just my trip to the hospital. I'm always in the hospital. That's not exciting.
Well, that's definitely been a bit of an interesting week for me, as I've been contacted several times regarding the BBC to do a bit of projects. And one of them was actually live this week. I was part of BBC Five Live Breakfast Show, where I was on with Nicky Campbell, part of the celebrations of the Disability Discrimination Act 21st anniversary, where we were just talking about, you know, the lives of disabled people. So they wanted my view from somebody here from the North. And also just to give an opinion on what's happening, you know, with regard to COVID lockdown. So it was an interesting conversation with Nicky Campbell and his team. So, but I want to thank Elliot Palmer for connecting me with that, because this was part of his segment that he was doing it, because Elliot as well, he is also a disabled person. So this was a project that was very, which is obviously very passionate for him, so I knew it was going to be done in the right manner. But again, it was a great discussion, because there was several people with disabilities on at the same time, and, you know, from the different regions, you know, in Scotland, North England, South England, and of course Wales. So I didn't see your voice there, but
Oh, well,
But it
there's
was
always
interesting
next time.
that we were just sort of chatting about the different regions. And although we might have different narratives of what was happening in the individual regions of UK, but there was a common trait about, how we were feeling and what the actions were, and just exactly how prioritized we were within each of the governments and parliament was helpful. So it was an interesting discussion, and the feedback that I've been seeing, not just to myself but to the BBC directly, has been fantastic, particularly from non-disabled people, because I do think it opened their eyes quite a little bit to what has been going on. But because of the breakfast show and that, I just hope that this eye-opening will be sustained and maybe not forgotten about come lunchtime or dinner time. But for that time, in a way, it was good to get a wee over. And I do think that we did help. And, particularly was it being the 25th anniversary of the DDA, it kind of highlighted just how far disabled people have come in the 25 years. Just how much further we have to come, especially now under COVID, because, even before COVID, disability rights and equality haven't been reached yet. It's been a lot better over the 25 years because of the DDA. But unfortunately, some acts are still full of gaps and they still need to be filled. But, like myself and many other disabled people across the different countries, it's something that we're working upon actively, and a few things I'm involved in now that I've been tenaciously about, but when the time's right, I'm able to share these all as well. But but I can see, here in the north, and I'm sure across the different countries, that disabled people are starting to bang the door again. We will make these changes happen. But as well as that, I also appeared on the BBC yet again that evening.
I do find that when you give them your number, they tend to phone up again and again. So anytime I've done a BBC thing, you tend to get like four or five phone calls that week because they pass the number on to like another journalist, and you just keep getting calls, which is great for disability recognition and awareness, but it's a lot.
That well, this thing was a documentary that I recorded in February, just before lockdown. So if you're watching it and you see me looking happy, well, I didn't know what was coming. But basically, it was a discussion. It was led by a man from Belfast, a disabled man called Chris Lynch, and it was produced for the BBC by Triple Vision, which is a County Tyrone and Donegal Moor based television company. So basically, he was going around different people, and it was five people with disability, because he wanted to find out what the link between being disabled and their mental health. Can you be happy if you're disabled? So I was one of the ones that was selected to be here. So he came to my house and we had a good chat. And I think anybody knows me. I think what Chris had said in the when he introduced me in the program was anybody that knows David Devlin will appreciate how online antics on Twitter. I'm not sure what he means by that, literally, but apparently my Twitter gets noticed. But to me, I was shown that, yes, people, you can have your down there for that, but that's not necessarily connected with being disabled. There's certain things about your disability that might annoy you, might upset you on a day-to-day basis. Not on a day-to-day basis, but a certain time. But that could be said about anybody who is non-disabled. There might be something that would happen that would upset them, but just move on. And it seemed to be the running core between many of the disabled people that were interviewed. I must say that certain aspects of the program might come as a trigger warning, because some of them will speak openly about certain periods of their life, which maybe some viewers might find a little bit difficult to deal with. But again, the outcome of that has been quite positive from the experience. But so if you maybe find it difficult to watch because you maybe go through that experience as well, ultimately you will find a lot of hope from it, because there's certain people who were disabled and went through the same experience as you. But actually came out the other side and very happy with it. So but it was great. And one of the things I was very excited about the programme that he was sort of wanting to pick out bits of the individual life just to show just how happy several people can be in their life and what they do. And one of the areas he focused on me was my love of cosplay. So if anybody's wondering what I'm like when I'm doing cosplay, you know, if you want to tune into the BBC on the iPlayer, you'll see me dancing about Dublin, doing what I love best. But also, if you live within Britain itself, so if you're in Scotland, England or Wales, and you want to watch the programme, and possibly if you live in Stephen Diggs and your internet connection isn't that good, and you can't watch it on the BBC iPlayer, it will be repeated on Wednesday night at 9 o'clock on BBC Four, which is part of the BBC's months-long celebrations of the Disability Discrimination Act 21st anniversary. So if you want to watch it, it'll be... But I'll also link the iPlayer link below, as well as the BBC Five Radio Live link to the Mickey Campbell Show, which I'm also on. So that was basically my life in the BBC. This week, so I've been, can probably understand me why I was feeling a little bit tired, a little bit drained this week. So, come from us on Friday, I'm back to myself again. I'm back annoying everybody around me with my burst of energy.
Yeah, I think the BBC programmes on disability are really interesting, and they're probably something that we are going to cover on the podcast at some point and discuss, because there has been some really interesting topics raised and some which people have found quite controversial in some of the documentaries that have been on there. I happen to be doing some Disability History Month celebrations early with the university, because obviously students are going to be leaving in December to go home. So we started it in November, and we're having a ramp up your voice event to get disabled students and staff to talk about accessibility issues in the university, which is really important because there are quite a few access issues in university. And like, as we said, there have been issues with disabled students allowance and for students accessing it. And I think it's an issue that Disabled Students UK, which is a grassroots organisation which is led and controlled by disabled students, has really covered and addressed. And they've been calling for sort of more strict rules on universities that are failing in access. So I think this is hopefully a really good event to get these discussions going. But also, we're planning to have Netflix watch parties with movies that tackle topics about disability or that are disability led. So we're doing Crip Camp and things like that as a watch party. So it should be really, really good. I'm hopeful. And we're including a Disability Hall of Fame, which one of my friends, Kate Cleaver, has written a couple of biographies for, and which is going to be permanently published on the Student Union website, which I think is really, really important. And Kate has specifically focused on invisible disabilities for that. So I'm very excited about these events.
Again, like, I'm very excited to hear some of that stuff, especially the Hall of Fame. So, listen, whenever this is all published on the website, that we will link it on the podcast as well as on my Access page for people to see. And I'm sure I'm chronically fabulous as well, because I do think it's important to educate, particularly, disabled people themselves who maybe are looking for a role model to see, you know, to say, because some people may be finding difficult, especially in the early days of being disabled, that, you know, it's a bit of a hindrance, or maybe it's something that they feel negatively about. So to see positive reinforcement, which is unfortunately not that well seen in the media at the moment, it will, and I hate this word, but I think in this word, in this occasion, it's probably right, but hopefully it would inspire them, you know, to be the person that they want to be, and be the person that they can be, importantly. But also to ask that even for non-disabled people as well, just to show that disabled people in history have made a positive impact on society around them. But unfortunately, history has decided to delete their disability from their narrative.
So yeah, it's something I tackle a lot in my work.
Like one person who I discovered quite recently, possibly you told me this, let me just can't remember, was W.B. Yeats. I didn't realise.
I'm not sure I told you that, but yes, you are right.
If anybody knows, it was a great Irish literature. Senator, but as well as that, they served and two terms in the Irish Senate. You know, and that, I mean, for somebody who has a learning disability, you know, that just shows you that, I mean, he had a massive impact, not just on Irish history itself and Irish culture, but across the world. So we need to be more outspoken and be, speak more about our disability history, our disabled history. So this is a fully endorsed, and I'm really excited to hear more about this because it's something that I'm learning more and more about through my conversation, both offline and online from this podcast with you. So I think it's, for me, it's actually opened my eyes out. And while I'm a very positive disabled man, it's actually filled me with even more pride in being disabled. And I think that's just something that needs to be encouraged by everybody. So if you're disabled, be proud of it and tell people. And as well as that there, you know, find out about disabled history. Brilliant.
Yeah, because like disability isn't a bad word. It does get a bad rep from some people who, generally non-disabled people, who think of it as negative or as tragic, but disability isn't that. But I do believe you also had some other news this week, some good news, some bone-related news, which had me slightly jealous as a person with very bad bones.
Well, yes, I have been going through treatment for the last 2 years. I take a 2 tablets every day for the last 2 years to help improve my osteoarthrosis, which I've been told before I started the treatment was the same level. What he recited, I was 30 years, no, I was 36 at the time, but my bones were the same as a 7-year-old woman, which was quite alarming when I heard that. But so I got started on this treatment. But as well as that, I would take an annual infusion every year, which I had just finished up last year. But my consultant, Dr. Armstrong, rang me on during the week just to tell me that my bones have actually improved over the last 3 years. So it's now by improved by, in some cases, 25%, which is fantastic. And still get the pain from it, but it means then if I fail, you know, there's less chance of me breaking the bone or doing damage in the bone, which is all I really want. You know, I've got used to the pain there and I can manage that. That's okay. But the fact that I less risk of breaking my bones, that's fantastic news. But what my doctor Armstrong, who's a fantastic man, he has informed me that he's actually a regular listener to the podcast. So I just want to give a big shout out to Dr. Armstrong and thanks for listening. And I know he's a big advocate of, as he can tell me now, that he's been sort of influenced by some of the things we talked about. So one of the things he now talks about is nothing about us without us, because he is actually going to write a paper on the treatment he gave me. He would like my input into it as well, which I'm absolutely delighted to do. And it just reinforces the idea, nothing about it without it. And that includes medical papers, you know, cause as well as having the medical jargon. Dr. Armstrong and myself both feel it is important to give the voice and the narrative from the person who's actually treating, getting the treatment, just to see how they feel and how they benefit too. Because you do need both sides of the story to give the full story. And I just think that's fantastic. So thank you, Dr. Armstrong, for your help over the last 3 years, and been a great friend over the last 3 years, which I'm sure we'll still make regular contact as well, don't worry. But in fact, well, I've been an avid listener to the podcast, been great. And I know Felicity, and we've been chatting offline, so she's very keen to hear more about this medication and treatment that I've been getting to, because I think she said her bones are slightly older than 70. I didn't want to ask her too much, because it's very rude to ask somebody that, you know. But so I'd love to hear more about the treatment at some stage. So, Felicity, maybe you want to share a bit more about that?
Yeah, no, I think the treatment sounds absolutely amazing. I know that every time I have a DEXA scan, it's worse. So at the minute, my spine generally, occasionally, feels like one of those fancy salt grinders you see in a fancy restaurant, just grinding. And so when my electrolytes go, I tend to feel my pain more acutely. So occasionally, I get told off for lying down on the hospital floor because I can't manage to sit in the chair because gravity seems to be like a pressure on the spine. So I'll be lying out flat because that's more comfortable. But I think it's more the fact that it's had such amazing results for you. And I think that's really hopeful for a lot of people who are experiencing osteoporosis or any sort of like bone issues. Because like I'm turning 30 soon. And it was, I think, about 2 years ago, I was told that I was starting to develop a kyphotic hump. And, you know, I've lost about an inch plus in height. And I don't actually know if it's osteoporosis related, but I do know that I used to be size 5 in shoes and I'm now size 4, and all my wonderful high heels at the time had to go to my sister, who loved it. So I think, like, you know, new developments in and things like this, and to hear that it's been so successful for you is absolutely amazing, because I'm on calcium tablets daily at the minute and have been for 9 years plus, I think, now. And just unfortunately, my DEXA scans don't seem to improve every time I'm in. So it is really hopeful to hear about treatments being successful. And like 25% is absolutely amazing. Like I'm just over the moon for you, and really hopeful that hopefully this could lead to further developments and further treatment for other people.
Thank you. But I think that really covers everything now. So Felicity, maybe if you want to maybe take one, but say to our listeners, maybe one point I'd like to take away from discussions today, whether that's from the weekly discussions or the main discussions on COVID, or even some of the things we talked about in our life just there in the last 10 minutes, what's the one thing you'd like people to take away?
I think maybe consideration of the fact that obviously masks are very important and PPE is very important, but for healthcare professionals to maybe consider about how they can be hidden under it, and how there are ways to deal with that, with maybe having your name visible or maybe like a little photograph of yourself somewhere on it, something to kind of personalize it for the patient, because I find it very difficult to hear staff. I also found it very difficult to recognize staff who I knew and who I was familiar with. And it can be quite daunting if you aren't a regular person in hospital and you're seeing staff in PPE. And it was daunting for me seeing staff in the full PPE as well. So I think consideration of that, I'd quite like to see more clear masks coming in so that people could lip read maybe in hospital settings. But I think just maybe being aware that staff are overstretched, understaffed, dealing with an awful lot, and they're under, you know, layers of PPE, which is difficult to work in. And so while it would be nice to have like a little bit of something to make it more familiar or to personalize it for the patient, I think also just sort of kind of quid pro quo and just consideration of the stresses and the additional work that staff are having to face at the minute.
No, I would totally agree with that. That's what my main talking point and takeaway. And I mentioned the last few things were about COVID, so maybe I might just shake it up a bit and talk about something a little bit different this week. But I think, particularly now over this month, even my own experience this week regarding being on the BBC, which has been the Disability Discrimination Act, you know, you see a lot of disabled people on various channels and various media talking about not just the Disability Discrimination Act 25th anniversary, but just about what it's like to be disabled and been given a real voice to discuss that, which is great, you know, for November, and, you know, I've always supported it. But I do think this is something that the media need to fully endorse and not just become a 1 month or a 1 week or an anniversary special where we get disabled people on top of this thing, which has been fantastic. I mean, the feedback I've been seeing, you know, from the radio show and from the BBC been really positive, not just from disabled people, but from non-disabled people too. You know, I've been getting messages from everywhere, and I know that even the BBC has been getting that from non-disabled people. But crucially, from the non-disabled people, it seems to educate them a little bit, that because normally when you see disabled people, you'll get sort of a sympathetic or feedback, whereas this seems to be really positive. And the fact that they're recognizing us as real people, I don't know, I'll probably find them a strength where there'll be someone that listens or maybe not is able to maybe to understand what I mean by that. But what I'm trying to say is maybe it's something that should be rolled out on a permanent basis. And not that we have to be on talking about disability every week, but just that we are there, we are seen. And that might just mean disabled newsreaders, disabled actors, representing disabled characters, you know, not sort of getting in non-disabled people to portray disabled people in films and TV shows. Crucially as well, that when you're TV programmes or film, we're not there to portray a trope, you know, to portray a narrative, and then we'll disappear again. So I do think, you know, this should be the starting point where we see more and more disabled people represented in the media, you know, film, TV, radio, newspaper, books, everything, but in a real way, not just to fill in a non-disabled person's narrative. So, yeah, that's my takeaway for the week.
I think that's a really good takeaway, and I think that's a really good place for us to wrap up.
So I think that's really about it. So thank you very much for listening this week, and I hope you have a lovely week ahead. So just please remember, look after yourself, stay safe, socially distant, and don't forget, wear a mask.